Hi all. Sorry about that. Joanna Dorinova here from Sydney. So it's my great pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker, Graham Innes. Well, as you know, he's the Disability Discrimination Commissioner. He's also a long-term member of BCA and was the first president of Vision Australia once it was formed. He's been instrumental in the development and success of a number of initiatives, including a large involvement in the National Disability Insurance Scheme, in the National Disability Framework, and in advocating for captioning and audio description in cinemas. He's been... we're very happy to have him here. He's had some family matters to attend to, so that's led to a bit of shuffling in our program. But it does mean that he's essentially had to fly in and fly out again. So we're extremely grateful that he's taken the time to come and talk to us. So without further ado, I'll hand over to Graham.
Thanks, Joanna, for that introduction, and may I apologise for causing you to reorganise your program. If it's of any reassurance to you or consolation, I have a 15-year-old at home whose mum's overseas and who's very pleased that her dad's not leaving her for as long as he had suggested he would. She's not well at the moment, so... I also would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet this morning. In the current era of cyclists making confessions, it's time I made my own. I've had a mistress all my life. She's been generous, giving, and caring. I've fallen to sleep in her embrace on many nights and often woken to her cool caress. She's taught me, made me laugh, kept me informed, and challenged my views. And she's sometimes been very cruel. My affair started when I was not much more than a boy. She took me to secret places in my imagination with her conversation, her drama, and her entertainment. She understood my love of cricket and catered to it, telling me of cricket matches day in and day out, and sometimes late into the night. She told me stories, gave me news, and let me listen to various opinions. She recognised my love of music and took me to many different genres. But she can also be very cruel. She's been cruel to me before, and we've argued, and she's going to be cruel to me again in a few weeks' time. Her main means of cruelty is taking things away that I love. My mistress is the ABC. Our affair started with the Argonauts and blossomed into a range of plays, serials, news, current affairs and music. And of course, cricket. Later, our affair became visual as well as oral when she introduced television. Our daily tete-a-tete at 7 p.m. for the news is a ritual rarely missed. She's gone to the four corners of my life, entertained me with The Chaser and much other comedy, and even looked after my children with Play School, B1 and B2, and Mr. Squiggle. In years gone by, she provided me with the ABC cricket book in Braille, the medium in which I read, each summer. Then she took that away. She replaced it with Jim Maxwell's dulcet tones, reading the ABC cricket book onto cassette. Then she took that away. In desperation, I deserted her for another source of this information. I scanned the book and used my computer to read it to me in synthetic speech, a poor substitute embrace to fall into when she had left. I shared this scanned file with others, and she threatened to sue me for breach of copyright. She entertained me regularly on Sundays with radio drama. Then she took that away. But now, the unkindest cut of all. About 10 weeks ago, she opened a new window on my world. She lifted the veil from the television screen. She provided me with audio description. Audio description provides someone such as me, who can't see the TV screen, with information about what's going on. It tells me of the movements of Lionel and Jean in As Time Goes By. It lets me know what's happening in Rake and Sherlock and other detective mysteries when the dialogue is deficient. And it introduced me to the first episode of Jack Irish last week by telling me of the shooting of Jack's wife Stella by Jack's outraged client in the car park. I'd never have understood that without audio description. And now, in 2 weeks' time, she's taking this away. She's closing this window on the world of ABC television for me and 600,000 other Australians who can't see the TV screen. Marvel's lines to his coy mistress are perhaps apt. Had we but world enough and time, this coyness lady were no crime. She doesn't need to be cruel. She could leave this window open. I could continue to enjoy, through audio description or AD, the same benefits of all of those Australians who can see the TV screen. So, Mark Scott and Stephen Conroy, leave my AD on TV. After all, it's as easy as ABC. I thought I'd start today by sharing that with you. That's an op-ed, an opinion piece, which I drafted just last night, and I'm planning to have it have someone run it next week, because it's time we ramped up this campaign. So let me ask you some questions. Who sent a postcard to the ABC about this campaign? All right, who hasn't sent one? Well, you should be feeling two emotions. Shame for not doing it, and bravery for admitting that you haven't.
Some of us haven't received.
I've got some here, so we can solve that problem, and I'm sure that VCA will solve that problem in the broader terms. But, sir, I can give you some at the end of this speech.
Very well done, thank you.
300,000 people who are blind or have low vision in Australia. About 100,000 in New South Wales. How many of them are here today? How many of you use audible traffic signals? Yeah, most of you. How many of you lobbied for audio traffic signals? Not so many. How many have reported if they don't work? Okay, good. How many have sought further installation of audible traffic signals?
Yeah.
A few. Okay. How many of you use internet banking, phone banking, and audible talking ATMs?
Yeah.
About maybe half. How many of you lobbied for their installation or improvement? 3, 4. How many have complained if they're not available or not operating? 1 or 2. How many of you have attended a cinema where there's audio description?
Yes.
Okay, maybe a quarter. How many of you lobbied for its commencement?
Yes.
About the same number. Good. How many of you have travelled on a New South Wales train? You knew I was going to get here eventually. How many of you have travelled on a New South Wales train and used the audio announcements?
Yeah.
Yeah, most. Most. How many of you have lobbied for such announcements or complained when they don't occur?
Yeah.
Not too many, maybe half a dozen. And we're the active leaders of advocacy in New South Wales. We're the ones who do this stuff. And only a few of us have actually done it. Now, I'm not criticising anyone in this room. Advocacy is hard. Lobbying and complaining is hard. We all have our lives to lead. We all have other things to do. Some of us have 15-year-old daughters at home sick. So I'm not criticising any of you, but I'm making the point that this stuff doesn't just fall into our lap. I want to tell you a story. It's a true story. It's a story of advocacy. And it's one of many that could be told about all of us in this room, or many of us in this room, and at other BCA conventions throughout Australia. It's a story that doesn't yet have the last chapter written. I grew up using trains. Mum didn't drive. I went to a Stedfords on trains. I went to cricket matches at the SCG with Mum on trains. You can see the role cricket's had in my life. I visited friends with the family. I went to Newcastle on trains to visit my aunt. I played a game called Railway Fun at school, where some teachers with a great deal of foresight constructed a game in the shape of the Sydney railway system and encouraged us to move our way round it and thus learn the stations and the traffic lines. What a smart move that was by some of the teachers at North Rocks. I went to football with my brother on trains. When I started using a cane, I went to visit friends, to social events, to university and to work. Trains have been an integral part of my life. Here, in Perth where I lived, in London where I lived, in New York where I've worked, and in places where I've travelled. Now, running next to this story, on the next track you might say, is a story of law and of discrimination. In 1983, New South Wales Anti-Discrimination Act was amended to include disability discrimination. That is, less favourable treatment on the ground of a person's disability became discriminatory. Now, if a transport provider tells people who can see, through signs, screens, etc., where they are on a train, and not a person who can't see, isn't that less favourable treatment? Well, Barry Chapman, amongst others, thought it was, and he lodged complaints. And others in BCA supported him and thought it was as well. He lodged complaints against the State Rail Authority, I think it was called then, Barry, wasn't it? Yeah. It changed its name a couple of times since, but you know, they still run the same trains around. And they were about the lack of announcements on trains. And those complaints weren't resolved. In 1993, federal discrimination law commenced, and it introduced the same concept of less favourable treatment on the ground of disability. Now, if a transport provider tells people who can see through signs and screens, etc., where they are on a train, and not a person who can't see, isn't that less favourable treatment? Well, again, some of us thought it was, and lodged complaints about the lack of announcements. City Rail didn't resolve those complaints. In 2002, the DDA Accessible Transport Standards under the Disability Discrimination Act were introduced. The way that they work is that they set out a 20-year timetable by which transport systems are to become accessible. The provision of information in alternate formats, that is, what's written on the signs and on the screens, is to be made available audibly or in some other form. And that was required to happen by 2007. After this date, some of us thought that there ought to be announcements on every train telling us where we were. And we raised that issue and made complaints. And Rail Corp didn't resolve those complaints. What was happening during this time? Well, this matter was one for constant discussion. Constant discussion. In the 80s and 90s, through transport committees, after transport committees, with BCA. In this century, with BCA, with Vision Australia, and with Guide Dogs New South Wales. Rail Corp recognise their obligations. We know that because as newer trains are rolled out, automated announcements became available. 99% of the times out of 100, automated announcements work, unless there's some sort of equipment failure, which doesn't happen very often. And automated announcements are made. Rail Corp understand this stuff. But what has happened? Constant discussions. And on older trains, around 70% of the fleet, so virtually 2 out of 3 trains, announcements are often not made. Now, I naively expected all stations to be announced by December 2007, the end of the five-year point of the transport standards. So I just thought, well, there's a law in place now that specifically says this is going to happen. I don't need to do anything else. It didn't occur. So let's pause the story here. And let me talk for a minute about the impact of not knowing where we are as people who are blind or have low vision. Now, of course, we've got other ways to work it out. They've been used by me for all of those train journeys I told you about, and they've been used by you and used by others. Sounds of tunnels and bridges, changes of light, station announcements if you can hear them, iPhone apps, asking other passengers, and the risk involved of the information you'll get. Of course, we can usually do it. We can usually work it out. Some of us do it most days. And most times we get it right. And sometimes we get it wrong. And arriving at the wrong station is not just annoying and a waste of our time, it's unsafe. Marion Jones, in the statement that she provided for the case that I'm currently conducting, described how it was unsafe, how she was left at the wrong station late one night, decided that it was safer to catch a taxi than wait the hour or so for the train to go back, and found that she had to walk through a dimly lit or unlit car park late at night on the Central Coast. Not a safe position for a woman, particularly a blind woman, or perhaps a blind person of any gender, to be. And there are many other stories of safety. And making an extra effort to know where we are also has an impact. The impact on me. I can tell you of the tension before the journey that I feel in my shoulders and neck. The little knot of concern that I feel in my stomach. The worry. The uncomfortable journey, having to concentrate all the time on where I am. I can't read. I can't work. I can't relax. I'm more tired at the end of the day. I get more headaches. My family tell me, and they're probably right, that I get more grumpy. Others who provided me with statements in the case that I'm running against Rail Corp confirm these sorts of reactions. And I've heard them also in conversations with many of you and many others. They're similar with some differences. Some people avoid catching the train. They take taxis instead and incur the extra cost. Some are concerned about safety, particularly getting off at the wrong station. Most people try, of course, to diminish the impact because you don't want to let that sort of thing get you down. You don't want to go around in life complaining about the impact that it has on you because, unlike the other commuters on the train, you don't know where you are. But it's there and it's always there, and the risk of it is there in every journey. Well, what could I do next? To go back to the story, was there an action I could take as the commissioner? I could go and wave my finger. I could go and point out the law. I could talk to Rail Corp about what they were doing. And what effect... I had a bit of competition here. And what effect did that have over the last 30 years? Damn all. Well, what could I do as an individual? Well, as an individual, I decided that I'd had enough, that I wasn't prepared. Maybe you could take that phone call outside rather than inside, because I don't know if anyone else is finding it problematic, but I am. I wasn't prepared to wait any longer. I wasn't prepared to tolerate it any longer. So I went to Rail Corp, to the CEO of Rail Corp, and to the new Transport Minister in 2010, and I gave them 6 months. And I said that after that 6 months, if they hadn't fixed the problem, then every time I travel on a train where there was no announcement, I would lodge a complaint, a DDA complaint. And I started lodging those complaints in March 2011. The first 36 complaints, as many of you know, are in court now, in the Federal Court. Because Rail Corp didn't want to even come and participate in a conciliation conference at the Australian Human Rights Commission because they said I was misusing my power as the scary disability discrimination commissioner. We had a mediation in the federal court and that was equally unsuccessful. And up to now, as well as those 36 complaints which are in the federal court, there's another 34 complaints, so I'm up to over 70 complaints that are in the queue to go into the federal court. And I will keep lodging complaints every time I travel on a train and Rail Corp doesn't tell me where I am. Now, I'm not suggesting that they don't tell me where I am every time. In fact, the failure rate at the time my complaint started, based on my complaints and the number of complaints that I lodged over periods of time, appears to be around 18 to 19% of the time. So, four in five they get it right. One in five they don't. Rail Corp evidence suggests that it was higher than that. Their survey suggests it was up to 10% higher than that. So maybe it was 29%. Some of you may agree with the Rail Corp figure, or you may say that it's even more. Now, the failure rate now, after the lodging of most of those complaints, according to the mystery shopper surveys that Rail Corp have put in their evidence, and the supervisor checks that they've put in their evidence to the federal court, appears to be around 7%. Now, some of you might question that figure. Some of you might still say it's more than 7%. I actually think that that figure's about right. And I'll let you draw your own conclusions as to the reason for the improvement. But I think you might find that he's talking to you now. Particularly after my experience to date, I'm not critical of anyone who hasn't lodged complaints. As I said at the start of this presentation, this stuff is hard. You have to be determined. You have to be persistent. You have to be stubborn. You have to be prepared not to be ground down by the big bureaucracy, which says, look, we're trying our best. We're doing fairly well. Yeah, don't be mean to us. Leave us alone and in time, in our own sweet time, we'll fix the problem. They said that in 1983. They said that in 1992. They said it in 2002 and they said it in 2007. And it's only when I lodge 70 complaints in large numbers and use the media against them that they really lifted their game. They did some work on it before that, but they didn't really try. Well, it's time they did. And even when I've gone this far, and even when, as I did again last week, I offered them a settlement of the case which involves them publicly committing to a target for percentage of announcements made and a time to achieve that target, they won't settle my complaints. Why? Because they still hope that by delaying and delaying and delaying, I will eventually go away. Well, I won't. I plan to see this through to a court decision, which I hope will occur early next year. Now, let's be realistic about this. I probably won't get the court to set the target that I want, because courts have been very reticent about doing that and providing us with systemic change in discrimination decisions. They maintain the importance of dealing with an individual's complaint as an individual matter. So the reality is, I'll probably not get the target that I want. But if I win, and if I receive an award of damages for each journey, and I've lodged each complaint about each separate journey, and I expect to do both of those things, then every time there's no announcement on a train on which I travel, I'll expect the same amount of damages to be paid to me. And if we can't get agreement to a target, we'll get there with the payment of money. So what have I learned from this process about advocacy and campaigning? Well, I've learned it's much easier with support, and I've really valued the support that I've received on this from a number of people in this room, a number of people who aren't in this room, and from a number of organisations. That support makes a huge difference. And BCA know that, because the successful BCA campaigns have been with that level of support. I've learned that it's really hard to do this stuff. There have been times when I, the determined, my wife might say stubborn, discrimination lawyer who understands the process in detail, there have been times when I've wanted to give up. Don't tell RailCorp that. There are those times for all of us, and we have to push through those times. I've learned that you're not a whinger if you go to the DDA or you lodge a complaint. I've learned that there is nothing wrong with asserting our rights. Our rights don't come to us and fall into our lap, as with all of those other campaigns that I talked about. People had to lobby. The audible traffic signals, the audio description on the ABC, the audio description in cinemas, the ATMs, the telephone banking, the electronic banking and the access to websites, they didn't come and fall in our lap. Bruce Maguire and many others that I could name campaigned for them, and that's how we got them. But what's the most important lesson that I've learned? It's the importance of organisations like this one, like BCA. Because campaigning together, working strategically, we can achieve systemic change. Not just for me, not just for each individual complaint, but for all of us. The Disability Discrimination Act and advocacy activities are not the perfect tool, and they're not easy. But those tools can be an effective tool for change, but they won't have any effect if we leave them in the tool shed. Thanks for the chance to speak to you this morning.
Graham, thank you so much for that inspirational and stirring address. I think it's got us all riled up and ready to be advocating for our causes. And
when you can't drink with us, you can drink at home.
Not with the 15-year-old.
Yeah. Well, that might help you get through that 15-year-old's illness. Thanks again, Graham.